The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up for the Bible study segment, we'll continue on with the study that we started yesterday. We were just about to get into quite a few scriptures on how that we want smooth things today. So many of us, instead of hearing the truth, and of course, so many of the preachers and the commentators are quite happy to comply with what the public wants, instead of preaching God's warning, instead of declaring the truth, even if it might be an unpopular message. So many people prefer to, as Winston Churchill said, we just prefer to be humbugged. We prefer to receive delusional thinking. We prefer lies and deceit over the truth. So that's coming up in the second segment. In the first segment here, we'll just rattle through as much of the news items that we thought were worth getting into. Donald Trump, of course, is in, I guess he has a two-day visit in India. And if you've seen pictures from that that visit, he's well-received. It seems almost like a political rally here in the U.S., full of Trump supporters. He met with Prime Minister Modi in the world's largest cricket stadium. I think 110,000 people came out to see the president speak. No telling how many crickets that stadium actually would hold. In any event, lots of cheering, lots of excitement. The president and his wife, they also visited the Taj Mahal last night, I guess, before retiring to their hotel room. And some of the coverage back in the United States, well, if we feel inclined to later on, we'll look at some of the ridiculous reporting on the president's dietary habits, of all things. Seems like reporters are concerned about what he might or might not eat while he's in India. In Germany, there was a terrorist attack, or at least we assume it was a terrorist attack, yesterday when this vehicle at a German carnival, I think it was in the heart of Germany, in central Germany, this man drove his Mercedes into a large throng of people, and the police are calling it a deliberate act. Something like 50 people were injured, including 18 children. But what's really strange about this story, and really in some ways it's not so strange, is it? But the media are doing everything that they can to prevent, or rather the law enforcement agents, they're doing all that they can to prevent the media from speculating on the details of this attack or publishing any details about the perpetrator. Richard was searching and searching right up into the start of today's program, and he indicated that the police are demanding that people not publish pictures of the attacker. There was one individual who filmed the violent attack, and that individual, the one who filmed it, has been arrested, and so he's been stopped from distributing the video footage. And just by way of contrast, there was a far-right attack just last week, and the details about the attacker, his motives, and everything were published within hours, probably quicker than that. In this case, however, it's like there's a complete blackout, and so it makes you wonder what it is law enforcement officials there in the heart of Germany are trying to cover up. I think most people probably have a pretty good idea of why they're being so careful to let information out regarding this attack at this carnival yesterday in Germany. Of course, we know from Daniel 11 and verse 40 that the Assyrians and radical Islam, they will clash in these last days. It's coming to a head, And at some point, we know it's building and building and building. One isolated incident yesterday may be a good, and really not so isolated, I guess, when you look at the history in Europe, around the United States. Speaking of terrorism, America, there was an article, I think a week or two ago, in Foreign Policy, I believe, or Foreign Affairs, I guess it was, about America's defeat in Afghanistan. The subtitle says, America's Slow Motion Failure in Afghanistan. And really, this ties right in with so many of the things that we said right at the outset of the war against the so-called war against terrorism back in 2001, 2002. And you can remember, some of you, the early trumpets when we, following 9/11, some of those memorable trumpet issues where we talked about prophecies in Leviticus 26 and elsewhere, and how that this would not end well for the United States. The Taliban, you don't see too much in the news on this, but the Taliban has been making huge strides they've basically taken over much of Afghanistan, and the U.S. is working to try to negotiate some kind of relatively peaceful pullout. This is the United States trying to get out of a difficult situation. They just haven't been able to solve it. Foreign Affairs says the U.S. has been fighting a war in Afghanistan for over 18 years. It just gives some of the statistics here at the start. It says more than 2,300 U.S. military personnel have lost their lives there. More than 20,000 others have been wounded. At least 500,000 Afghans, government forces, Taliban fighters, and civilians have been killed or wounded. And then it says we've spent $1 trillion. The U.S. has dumped $1 trillion into the war in Afghanistan. And even though bin Laden's been taken out, there haven't been any other major attacks on U.S. soil since 9/11. Yet still, it says here, the U.S. has been unable to end the violence or hand off the war to Afghan authorities. And the Afghan government cannot survive without U.S. military backing. And so what will happen when the U.S. completely pulls out? It says there the Afghan government, it just can't survive without being propped up by the U.S., by U.S. forces. Further on, it says polls have found that a majority of Americans now view the war as a failure. A failure, a loss, a defeat. Brings to mind what Mr. Armstrong said following those years immediately after World War II, how that the United States has won its last war. We'll come to that in a second. But this Foreign Affairs piece says, every U.S. president since 2001 has sought to reach a point in Afghanistan when the violence would be sufficiently low or the Afghan government strong enough to allow U.S. military forces to withdraw without significantly increasing the risk of a resurgent terrorist threat. That day has not come. In that sense, whatever the future brings, for 18 years, the United States has been unable to prevail. You see, we don't want to overlook articles or headlines like this during this temporary resurgence, because when you look at the economy, and of course we saw yesterday just how fragile that is, I'll come to that in just a second, but when you look at the economy, when you look at the debt levels, when you look at these failures abroad militarily, this all points to so many of the prophecies discussed in the United States and Britain in prophecy. Herbert Armstrong's masterful work, 6 million copies distributed right around the world. Well, with respect to Afghanistan and those early trumpets, as I said, we had one in November 2003. My father wrote it. He said, most of our politicians, the press, and our universities do not understand terrorism, nor do they understand history. Winston Churchill says the history of man is war. Misinformed people like to believe that is not true. You see, they prefer to be humbugged. They don't want the truth. My father said, superpowers cannot survive in this evil, warring world without the will to wage long, hard wars. This is the real world in which we live. Fantasies won't change that reality. Ties right in with what we discussed yesterday. These fantasies, they're not going to alter the reality or the facts on the ground. Joel Hilliker had a piece in 2006, How to Lose a War. That's from thetrumpet.com. How do you lose a war? How come we don't have the will to defeat the terrorists? Because God's broken the pride of our power, as Leviticus 26 brings out. You can read that, Leviticus 26, verses 19 to 21. And coming back to what Mr. Armstrong said, years, decades ago, the United States has won its last war. That's in He Was Right, one of our more popular booklets. Well, I mentioned how fragile the U.S. economy is with the latest coronavirus scare, the spread of that virus moving into South Korea and Italy, and causing all sorts of economic uncertainty and turmoil. Some would say panic. Certainly panic in the international markets, the world, the global markets. You look at Italy in particular, they had, I think, 3 cases of the virus on Friday, and yesterday it was up to 270 with 7 people already dying. And so they're setting up checkpoints. Northern Italy, that's where it's been hit, I guess, the hardest. It's practically under lockdown. And you have other areas where these towns that have been hit by the virus, there's checkpoints. It's like something you'd see out of a movie, a Hollywood movie. As they're closing down roads, Austria, just for a short time, shut down train travel between the two countries. Reuters said shops are shut, bars are closed, and people speak to each other from a safe distance in northern Italy. That's in the heart of Europe now. It's no longer just confined to China primarily. You've seen the stories about South Korea. You've seen the stories about Iran. And Iran officials, by the way, blaming Donald Trump for the virus. They must be in communication with CNN and MSNBC. In any event, look at the economic impact. Just yesterday, this scare wiped out $1 trillion in the global stock markets. $1 trillion just disappearing into thin air. And you had some of the companies, the travel companies here in here in Europe, some of the airlines and such that have been hit hard because people fear that some of these roadblocks are going to start to prevent air travel as well. The AP, it said yesterday, shares are mostly lower, just to bring you right up to date with this morning. It says shares are mostly lower in Asia on Tuesday after Wall Street suffered its worst session in 2 years, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average slumping more than 1,000 points on fears that a viral outbreak that began in China will weaken the world economy. So it pretty much wiped out the gains for 2020, at least for Wall Street. And it happens in just one day. Let me remind you what Herbert Armstrong said in a sermon back in 1984. This is clip one.
But I believe that some event is going to happen suddenly, just like out of a blue sky, that is going to shock the whole world and is going to cause the nations of Europe to realize they must unite. Well, he said he believed that would have to happen too. Well, now I think I can see what may be the very event that is going to trigger it, and that is the economic situation in the world.
That's Mr. Armstrong saying that it was going to be economic turmoil that really accelerated, that accelerated the formation of those 10 kingdoms in Europe. And if you look at other things that he wrote, and we've quoted this before, basically him in 1983 just summarizing what it says in the U.S. and Britain in prophecy, Britain having lost its empire, Britain on the way down and out, And then the United States following that same downward path. And Mr. Armstrong encouraged us to prepare to greatly reduce our standard of living. Tighten our financial belts. Get ready. To get ready for those times ahead of us. Here's one more clip from that same sermon, 1984, clip two.
And in the days of these kings, those toes which represent a nation to be formed, as I told you, in Europe when they go together. Now they're trying to form that now, and this economic crisis may be the thing that'll plunge them into it.
The economic crisis serving as the catalyst to bring the... And really, that's one of, I'm sure, several others. We've talked about the rise of these authoritarian leaders around the world and how that too is putting a lot of pressure on Europe to put forward its own strongman, its own version of Donald Trump, the way they view it. But they want someone to compete with Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. All of these warning signs, just like I covered on yesterday's program. And then you look at our nations, the United States and Britain, and the attack from within, the latest trumpet. Again, I'll refer you to that fundamental transformation. You look at the great gains that Bernie Sanders made over the weekend. And of course, it seems like he's steamrolling his way through the nomination process. I guess we'll see what happens in South Carolina this weekend and then Super Tuesday next week. But it's divided the Democrat Party. Quite a few Democrats don't like this because, well, really, what Bernie Sanders represents, he represents what those other Democrats do, except that he just speaks openly about it. He's not so deceitful about his true intentions. And, of course, as you've heard even Barack Obama say before, we've got to be pretty deceptive about this. He doesn't use that word deceptive specifically, but he has said, look, the American people, they're not ready for revolution. So we've got to make these great gains at the ballot box first and then take to the streets and then revolt. Those that would say that Bernie Sanders is somehow he's being put forward because, well, Barack Obama wasn't radical enough. I think it was someone, maybe it was Laura Ingraham last night, who said that no, Sanders is the logical outgrowth of Obama. President Obama came into office, as you well know, vowing to fundamentally transform the United States of America. And what you see now with the front runner of the Democratic Party is just a continuation, an even more extreme version of that fundamental transformation. Or maybe we should say a more honest version of that desire to fundamentally transform the United States. Sanders has been getting all kinds of flack in conservative media just this week because of how much he's heaping praise on these authoritarian regimes in Cuba, in China now. Yesterday it was China. He's praising all of these communist regimes, saying that, well, okay, I don't really like how authoritarian they are, but hey, they've come in with these literacy programs, and oh, what about healthcare? And oh, what about pulling people out of poverty? You just wonder what, if this is the nominee, how hard will it be for President Trump's campaign to just fully expose this communist for who and what he is? Listen to this montage. This is Bernie Sanders today, and some of these clips are from Bernie Sanders years ago, and there's very little difference. It's the same man through and through. Clip three.
Everybody was totally convinced that Castro was the worst guy in the world. They forgot that he educated the kids, gave them health care, totally transformed a society.
I think it's also fair to point out that when we were in Moscow, for example, I think most of the people here also were extremely impressed by their public transportation system. Also, I was impressed by the youth programs that they have. They're palaces of culture for the young people.
Here he is explaining why the Cuban people didn't rise up and help the U.S. overthrow Cuban leader Fidel Castro.
He educated the kids, gave them health care, totally transformed the society.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad.
For some reason, I was being very excited when Fidel Castro made the revolution in Cuba. I was a kid and I remember reading that. And it was just seemed right and appropriate that poor people were rising up against rather ugly rich people.
So when Fidel Castro first came to power, which was when? 59? Does that sound right?
59, 60.
Okay. You know what he did? He initiated a major literacy program. And they helped people learn to read and write. You know what? I think teaching people to read and write is a good thing. China is another example. All right? China is an authoritarian country, becoming more and more authoritarian. But can anyone deny, I mean, the facts are clear, that they have taken more people out of extreme poverty than any country in history?
My vision is not just making modest changes around the edge. It is transforming American society. So when I use the word socialist, and I know some people are uncomfortable about it, I say that it is imperative that we create a political revolution.
That's Bernie Sanders. Over the years, talking about his intent to bring about a fundamental transformation. And so he's excited about what Castro did. He's excited about the public transport in Moscow and all the youth programs in Russia, in the former USSR. He's excited about what China's done to pull people out of poverty. And there's quite a few people in the United States who are excited about Bernie Sanders. Pulled in 46% of the vote over the weekend in Nevada. The Wall Street Journal says he did well with most voter groups, but especially the young and Latinos. Many of his supporters may not know what socialism means in practice, but they like his angry demands for social justice and for government to fix all of America's inequities. Here are young people. They don't even know what it really means, but they like it when he goes on his tirades. They like it when he says, hey, America's got to fix all of these inequities, and we've got to have free healthcare, and we've got to have free college, and we've got to have free this and free that. How much is this going to cost? He said yesterday on the healthcare, $30 trillion. $30 trillion. Medicare for all. That's just one program. And quite a few people are excited about this. He is stirring up the Democrat base and all the other challengers. Well, they haven't been able to really hit Sanders on much. Because as the Journal brings out, they all offer some version of Bernie Lite. And none speak up for the private economy. They don't speak up for capitalism. They don't speak up for America's founding. They all have some version of Bernie Lite. They agree with him, in other words. He's just a natural extension of what Barack Obama started. That New York magazine, I think this is from a lefty here, but he's worried. He's worried because he fears that Sanders is like another Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn thought he had the base. Corbyn thought he had enough popularity where he could become prime minister. But the closer he got to that office, the more he was exposed. You look at the election here in the UK just last year, and mostly, I mean, this is maybe an oversimplification, but mostly Boris Johnson just had to stand there and point at Jeremy Corbyn. See what he said? See what he wants? See what he believes in? See who his friends are? This is the New York Magazine. It says, in Britain, the Corbyn faction wrested control of the Labour Party, insisting its populist message would pull the working class away from conservatives. The Corbynites managed to gain control of the party and hold it, even as the signs of doom spread everywhere. For Bernie's most fanatical adherents, None of this matters. Sanders is a completely unique asset for the left, a proud socialist who holds national office, who will be too old to run again in the next election, if he isn't too old already, and who has no short-term successor. They have every incentive to imagine away his many flaws and to seize on the real but unlikely possibility he can defy the odds and win. What is shocking, it says, is observing how many other progressives have joined in this fantasy with them. And so you have some like James Carville who are sounding the alarm for Democrats, saying if this is a lose-lose proposition, I can understand the sentiment with the radical base, but this is no way to reach out to those in the middle. This is no way to get a majority. Now, America's deeply divided, so no matter who runs against Donald Trump, he's going to get quite a few votes. But you have to imagine the Trump campaign just rubbing their hands together, waiting for the blitz of campaign ads that will play some of the same footage that we just played for you a moment ago. Salon, the left-wing site, published an excerpt from a forthcoming book, Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go From the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. This book's coming out in April, I guess it is, and it's by these two left-wing journalists and members of the Democratic Socialists of America. Some of the highlights from their forthcoming book, according to Salon. It says here, if the democratic capitalist state were less developed, it might be possible to convince people to simply storm the gates, tear up the old rules, and start fresh in a socialist society. This is what socialists tried to do in Russia in 1917. The state was weak, and after centuries of autocratic rule, it didn't have much legitimacy in the eyes of most Russians. So revolutionaries could get popular support for scrapping it and starting over. These are two left-wing journalists basically saying that if the capitalist state was just a little bit weaker, well, I mean, we could do this too. As it is, we've got to make some gains first at the ballot box. But you see where they're headed. Just look at the direction. Look at the trajectory. Look at the warning signs. They're out there. The most extreme cases are, anyway. They're out there saying it. They're not even trying to disguise it. They're not even trying to conceal their true intentions. Bring down the system. It's just like Herbert Armstrong said, going way back into the 50s and 60s. Their goal is infiltration, but ultimately they want to bring down the whole system, the whole government, and just scrap everything and start over with this socialist paradise, the way they view it. It says here, eventually, after the left has won significant gains at the ballot box and in civil society, the capitalist class will take the gloves off against socialists and do whatever it takes to destroy our movement. Well, they have it backwards, don't they? There they are telling their readers, look, if we continue to do well at the ballot box, the capitalists, those greedy capitalists, they're going to come after us. They're going to attack us, and we've got to be ready to fight back. This is building toward Ezekiel 4 and 5. How will they react? They've already talked about burning down the cities, even if he doesn't get the nomination. What happens if he loses in November? We'll need to fight back, it says. The democratic road to socialism seeks not to elide this confrontation, but to make it possible. To replace capitalism with socialism, writes Blanc, socialists should fight to win a socialist universal suffrage electoral majority in government, parliament, and socialists must expect that serious anti-capitalist change will necessarily require extra parliamentary mass action, like a general strike and a revolution, to defeat the inevitable sabotage and resistance of the ruling class. There you see it. The gloves are off. The masks are removed. This is their ultimate aim. And politically speaking, as I say, you have to imagine the Trump campaign people preferring someone this far to the left, someone this open and honest about his true intentions. It'll be interesting to see how the news media cover this. There's a few. Chris Matthews has been pretty outspoken in his criticism for Bernie Sanders, although he had to come out yesterday and apologize because he brought up some obscure reference about Nazi Germany, and some on the left were upset by that. And so because there was some kind of loose connection to Nazi Germany and Bernie Sanders, he had this very sobering apology last night leading off his program. He was rebuked, and he went straight to the airways to correct his errors, his sins. Don't you know that those comparisons to Nazi Germany are reserved for Donald Trump alone? Nobody rushes to the mic to issue an apology for saying Donald Trump is Hitler. In fact, you can make that comparison outright. But there he was last night with a very humble apology for having offended Bernie Sanders. This is a man whose supporters, some of them, have pledged to burn the cities if he doesn't get the nomination. There's going to be some interesting things, I would think, even this next week, but up to when's the convention, in July maybe? This could be quite the summer, quite the spring and summer, with all of these Bernie supporters, Bernie Sanders supporters, all of this division, all of the infighting, more of it in the Democrat Party right now than in the Republican Party. And a lot of people, of course, worried, concerned, even on the left, that Sanders has no chance and that he's not only going to fail in his bid for the presidency, he's going to hurt all the other elections down ballot. Senators, congressmen, state officials, local officials, as people turn out to vote against democratic socialism, against communism. Well, if Jeremy Corbyn's political career here in the UK is any indication, it may be as exactly as some are saying. But as my father has said, even in the most recent trumpet, it's not going to end well for either party. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
That's Neville Chamberlain coming back from Munich in 1938. We played that clip, a longer version of it, yesterday. But you can see the reaction of the people who wanted to hear smooth things, who wanted to hear that there would be peace between Britain and Germany. As I said yesterday, here tyranny was just rapidly spreading across the continent. And these appeasers believed that they could hold the line or keep it in check with a piece of paper signed by Adolf Hitler. Winston Churchill at the time said that within a year, we'll know whether the policy of appeasement has appeased or whether it has only stimulated a more ferocious appetite. And he was right about that. The prophet of truth. He made that statement in November, and on September 1st, 1939, 10, 11 months after Churchill gave his warning, Nazi forces marched into Poland and thus began World War III. And really, it began before then. If you were watching events, if you were tuned into the warning signs, well, what does God say about, we see what they did when he came back with the piece of paper in 1938. What about our time today? Paul said we're living in perilous times, dangerous times. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 3, it says this, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. The time will come, Paul said. This is an end-time prophecy. 2 Timothy 3:1 says so. The time will come when people just won't listen to the truth. They prefer to be humbugged. They want smooth things, not sound doctrine. Verse 4 says, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. They don't want the truth. They prefer to hear lies and deceit. In the Churchill booklet, this is from my father, he said, that's the biggest challenge each one of us always face. Do we really want to hear the truth? It's your biggest challenge. It's my biggest challenge. He said that we have to have the courage to face the truth. In the same booklet, my father said, the mark of a great leader is someone who always tells the truth. He always tells the truth. He's not looking for, you know, feedback from opinion polls or focus groups. He's just there to tell the truth. It's not to give the most popular message. It's to tell the truth. And God says if what we're saying doesn't square with his word, then that's not the truth. That's in Isaiah 8 and verse 20, to the law and testimony. If they don't speak from this, there's no truth in them. Look at Isaiah chapter 30. This whole chapter, we generally focus on the few verses in the middle, but this whole chapter really has a lot of excellent instruction. Chapter 30 and verse 1, in Isaiah. It says, "Woe to the rebellious children, saith the Eternal, that take counsel, but not of me, and that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin." And what the prophet is saying here is that we're not actively seeking after God's counsel. We're looking to men. We're devising schemes that actually deceive people, that deceive the masses. We're not seeking God's counsel. We're not seeking God's spirit. Instead, we're adding sin to sin. And verse 2 says, "That walk to go down into Egypt, and have not asked at my mouth to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt your confusion." God's people, even in these last days, so many of them have returned to Egypt spiritually, just like they did in ancient Israel. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, we've got to learn from the lessons of the wilderness. We don't want to fall into the same sins, the same sinful traps that they did anciently. They got out there for a few days and then they wanted to go back. They started to revise their own history. They started to humbug themselves, saying that, well, you know, it wasn't so bad in Egypt. Here their children were being murdered. They were in captivity. They were in oppressive captivity and slavery. And they get out for a few days. They don't have a full meal on hand. And they immediately say, well, wasn't it better in Egypt? And what about you, Moses? Did you just bring us out here to die? That's expressions coming from people who wanted to be humbugged. They didn't want the truth. They wouldn't accept the truth. Well, God says to Isaiah here, verse 8, it says, "Now go, write it before them in a table and note it in a book, that it may be for the time to come forever and ever." So God told his prophet, make sure that you record this message. Put it down in writing. Record it in a book. And what was the message? Verse 9, it says that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Eternal, which say unto the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. These are people who want to be deceived. They don't want the truth. It's important that we understand the significance of this. This is a prophecy. The significance of this prophesied condition. We've talked often about so many other prophecies. I mentioned one in the first segment, the king of the north, the clash with the king of the south, Daniel 11 and verse 40. We've talked about the economic collapse and the acceleration of the formation of the United States of Europe. All of these prophecies, but this too is prophecy. The sentiment among our people, that appeasement mentality, don't tell us right things, give us smooth things. Tell us what we want to hear. Churchill said in 1932, and I mean this was early, this is right as Hitler's about to come into power in Germany. This was early on in the wilderness years. He said, "I cannot recall at any time when the gap between the kind of words which statesmen use and what was actually happening in many countries was so great as it is now. The habit of saying smooth things and uttering pious platitudes and sentiments to gain applause without relation to the underlying facts is more pronounced than it has ever been in my experience." If only he would have lived long enough to witness the 10-second soundbite, the shallowness of today. He said he couldn't recall a time when the words coming from statesmen and what was actually happening, they're so far apart. Well, look at where we are today. Some of the things you hear coming from statesmen. And then look at what's happening on the ground. Well, you had that one incident in Germany yesterday, as I say. Here's this terrorist attack, evidently. And then the authorities actively working to cover it up right away. Right away. Look at China and the coronavirus. It's now spreading out to other nations. So we're getting, a more accurate read on how many can be infected by this, how many can die. Whereas when it was more confined to China, you had state authorities there covering up a lot of it. Don't preach the truth. Just give us smooth things. Tell us everything's going to be great. Well, they got a lot of that message in the late 1930s. My father brought that out in a program from 2009. This is The Key of David, clip 5.
Or leading up to World War II, even in 1939, the very year that the war began on September the 1st that year, and the media and the government in Britain were talking about a golden age was about to dawn on the world. And it was just about it was the worst nightmare they'd ever experienced that was about to come upon them. So actually the media and the government and the people that were supposed to be warning them and telling them about what was coming were all wrong. They were all wrong about what was going to happen.
The media, you see, they should have been telling them about what was coming. But in too many cases, they were actively concealing it, covering it up. Or just like you see today, just covering the nonsense. I guess we could play that montage. Here's your media in the United States, so concerned about President Trump's diet. Listen to this and ask yourself, does this really keep me better informed? Does this really make me more of a sharp observer of world events and Bible prophecy? I forget the clip. Go ahead.
President Trump reportedly drinks up to 12 Diet Cokes a day.
The president doesn't look healthy. And
if you do the math, he was overweight, borderline obese. As far as his diet goes, pretty atrocious, frankly. A couple of cheeseburgers, a couple of fish sandwiches, chocolate shakes, steak with ketchup, 12 Diet Cokes a day. It's extraordinary, really.
Dinner, which has also raised the interesting question, what is the president going to eat? Modi is a noted vegetarian. He promotes vegetarianism every chance he gets. Of course, the president is known for his love of hamburgers and steak.
The world waits with bated breath on whether a Big Mac is smuggled in the back of the Taj Mahal.
Coming up,
more for the president to have a quick bite while sightseeing.
I mean, it's audacious. Donald Trump was the oldest president ever, one of the fattest presidents ever, the least physically capable president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in a wheelchair. I mean, he can't pick up a ball, never mind throw it.
We should also note that the president doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, and doesn't do drugs, and that's obviously in the plus column.
At least Jake Tapper adds a few positive things there at the end. But do you think these observers are going to be right on top of the dangers? The dangers are already surrounding us. And you see what they're obsessed with. And really, they're obsessed with this because they hope he dies early. They hope he continues on this course. Because any way possible for him to be removed from office, the sooner the better. Hopefully it'll be the cheeseburgers that take him out. But you go back to the 1930s. This is not new, the fake news of today. You had the Times of London, which, as Manchester brings out in his biography, it was essentially the voice of the British government. And Hitler had already militarized the Rhineland. He had already taken over Austria. And then when it comes time to take Czechoslovakia, you had the Times basically saying it was Czechoslovakia's fault, that it was Czech obstinacy. And they should quit being obstinate and just give Hitler the Sudetenland. That's the beloved London Times. And then when Hitler marches on Czechoslovakia, well, the news coverage that was put out then, if you're just watching it as a casual observer, you think, oh, well, I guess like in Austria, in Czechoslovakia, they actually like the Nazis. They've welcomed the Nazis with open arms. Manchester says about Fleet Street, that's the street famous for all of the newspaper publications from the 1930s, and I guess to some extent even to today, but he said Fleet Street withheld news of the moves and countermoves in London, Warsaw, and Berlin because they knew their countrymen would disapprove. So if they knew the countrymen would disapprove, they withheld it. They didn't say it. They didn't report it. It was all carefully constructed, the narrative, the storyline. Truth fails, as Isaiah said elsewhere in his book. Verse 11 here in chapter 30, it says, "Get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us." Well, just get out of the way. We don't want a representative of the Holy One of Israel bringing the truth of God to us. We want smooth things. Get the truth out of the way. Get rid of this warning message. Verse 12 says, "Wherefore thus says the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word and trust in oppression and perverseness, and stay thereon. Therefore, this iniquity shall be to you as a breach, ready to fall, swelling out in a high wall, whose breaking comes suddenly at an instant." The punishment coming upon our people. It's going to happen suddenly. That's why it's time for our people, our commentators, our observers to wake up and to start talking about the real warning signs. The real alarm bells. Sadly, though, and you can see this also in Isaiah, even when we see all of these dangerous developments around us, God says that our leaders are like lazy, slothful dogs. They're like dumb dogs that won't bark, even though there's danger all around. Well, Churchill was barking away following the disastrous negotiation in Munich, the sellout, the surrender. Churchill got up in front of the House of Commons and said, I'll begin by saying what everybody would like to ignore or forget, but which must nevertheless be stated, namely, that we have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat. We have sustained a total defeat. We've lost a war without firing a shot. They threw Czechoslovakia to the wolves, and everybody there to receive Neville Chamberlain back to London. We're cheering. Churchill said those people should have known the truth. He said the leaders in the UK should have told them the truth. They should know, the people, that is. They should know that there has been gross neglect and deficiency in our defenses. They should know that we have sustained a defeat without a war, the consequences of which will travel far with us along our road. They should know that we have passed an awful milestone in our history when the whole equilibrium of Europe has been deranged, and that the terrible words have for the time been pronounced against the Western democracies. You are weighed in the balance and found wanting. Again, quite a few biblical references in Churchill's writings at that time. Isaiah 56. And verse 10, this is where it talks about the watchmen. They're blind, it says. They are ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. They cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber, just sleeping away. Deep sleep. Verse 11 says, "The shepherds also have no understanding. They have all turned to their own way, each to his own gain, one and all. Come, they say, let us get wine. Let us fill ourselves with strong drink. And tomorrow will be like this day." great beyond measure. See, they're just intoxicated with the ways of this world. They're intoxicated with smooth things. They should be crying aloud as watchmen on God's tower. They should be talking about what's coming. They should be observing the events of this world and then sounding the alarm for the good of the people. They should be telling the truth. Instead, they're preaching smooth things. And you can't blame it all on the leaders, as I've said. The people, this is what we want. This is what we prefer. We prefer, just like Churchill said, we prefer to be humbugged. Well, what sets us apart in God's family is the truth. You shall know the truth, Jesus said, and the truth shall set you free. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.